Pauline Emily from also from Victoria. I'm also part of the Velvet Committee.
And Debbie, also in Melbourne and part of the Velvet and ACAL Committee.
I think that's everybody. Don's gone again, has he? I can't see his name on the list, so it looks as though he might have gone again. So welcome to those people, and as Sue said, some of you I have known a long time ago and haven't seen for a long time. Others I've seen more recently. I'm probably the most nervous one amongst you this evening because I'm a novice at this, so bear with me if I don't quite get things right. What I want to do is just talk briefly about the Velvet History Project. I did give a presentation at the Velvet Conference nearly three weeks ago now. And so what I'm going to try to do is give you tonight a bit of an overview of that and to give you a chance to talk about it. But I know that some of you don't have really close connections with Velvet, although you know about it, but living in other states, you don't have the close connections that we here in Victoria do. So what I'll try to do is to give you a bit of a history lesson, but also give you opportunity to connect in with some of the issues as well. I called the session at the Velvet conference the Velvet History Project from Mud Maps to Mainstream. And you will see on the screen at the moment two mud maps because very early fine prints used to put in mud maps to show people, to show members where the next production meeting would be to actually produce fine print. And so it would circulate from provider to provider and people would meet there, they would write copy. The editor would bring copy as well and they would actually type stuff in the meetings and then put it together at these meetings. So that's where I got my metaphor from for the first era. Debbie, perhaps if we go to the next slide. This is reading the fine print, so that the name that I gave to the Velvet presentation was different from the title of the history project, which I'm calling the working title at the moment is called Reading the Fine Print, A Short History of Velvet, and in the box you'll see the table of contents, the introduction, the Bootstraps era, the first section I'm calling the Bootstraps era, the next section is Voices and Versions of the Literacy Story, then there's a section that I'm calling Poets Corner, 100 Flowers Blooming, which is looking at the context of adult literacy and basic education, and then a section on professional identity. The section that I talked at the Velvet conference was the Bootstraps era, and I just tried to give people a feel for what this first era was like. The production of fine print falls very neatly into two eras. Actually, the chapter 100 Flowers Blooming, that was Daryl Evans' suggestion. That's rather a nice title, I think, for a chapter. The production of fine print falls into falls very neatly into two eras, really, from 1978, which is when Velvet began. The first fine print was produced in early in 1979, and then in 1993, there was a new editor appointed, and the look of fine print changed radically. And then the next 16 years, I'm calling Voices and Versions of the Literacy Story. At the Velvet Conference, I really only talked about the first era. And as I said, I tried to give people a feel for what that era was like. And I've just chosen tonight just one example that I talked about it being an era where people were on about spreading the literacy word. So Debbie, if we could have the next... I think the next slide. Oh no, I just to give a bit of context, before Velvet was actually formed in 1978, there was another publication that was produced by a group of people but funded by the Council of Adult Education, a very modest publication called the Victorian Adult Literacy News. As you can see, this was an era of do-it-yourself, where they wrote a lot of stuff by hand. It was typed up and then put into a very humble publication. Next slide, Debbie. This is the very first fine print, and again, it doesn't look very different from its predecessor, but this is the very first fine print that was published in 1979, in February 1979. And they didn't have a name at the first meeting. They had a whole series of suggestions of names, and they actually took a vote at the meeting, and this fine print was the name that was selected. And the logo that I think is on the next slide. Debbie, can you go to the next slide? The logo was designed by a fine arts student at Paran College of Advanced Education. And the first four fine prints were produced without the logo, and then this was actually put on in the fifth or sixth one of the first year. And it remained as the logo until 1993, when it changed. Okay. If we can now just go to the examples, the three examples. It was an era of high energy. The people just seemed to have an enormous commitment to actually spreading the literacy word, and I'm just waiting for the next slide to come up. Oh, that last one. Can you just go back, Debbie? Yes, that one is, as I said, it was an era of do-it-yourself, and people used to draw cartoons, and they were published in it. And this one is a cartoon by Peter Waterhouse of a fine print production meeting at Fern Tree Gully. It just shows everyone there putting it together, and then it was put around the table and people walked around and actually collated it. Are you able to go on, Debbie, with the... Now, these are just three examples of spreading the literacy word. This first slide here shows that in 1979, this badge was actually pinned to one particular issue of fine print, and I guess the expectation was that everybody would wear it and advertise the Victorian Adult Literacy Council. The council started off with the name Victorian Adult Literacy Council, and it wasn't until I think about 1987 that the name actually changed to Valbec to incorporate basic education as well. Okay, next one. This is also an example of spreading the literacy word. This brochure was published, I think it was 10,000 copies of this brochure were published. Can you read this? Others can't. And distributed very widely. Just another example of how important and urgent Valk at the time thought that the whole issue of literacy was. And the next one, Debbie. Maybe I'll just keep talking. What I want to do after this next slide, this is a page from fine print in 1985. One of the members, Rex Ennis, was going on the Great Victorian Bike Ride, and he offered to take literature with him and make contact with every adult literacy program along and down the Hume Highway, and he was going to call into all of the literacy programs on the way. And so this fine print was advertising what he was going to do. So I just thought that was one way of I mean, it's almost impossible to give you great detail about the project, but I thought that just gives you a bit of insight into the first era, and I just thought now might be worth stopping and hearing from you how long you've been involved and whether you identify with anything that I've actually put up on the screen at the moment and talked about. I mean, there's lots I haven't said, but I don't want to keep talking for too long. I want to give you a chance to talk as well. Okay, so I'll hand over to you now and let people talk about how long they've been involved and whether they identify with anything that I've said.
Hi, Bev and everyone. It's Sue here. This is really a fascinating coincidence. On Saturday, I went to a meeting of the South Australian Council for Adult Literacy people who were looking at adult literacy in South Australia over 30 years. And everything that you've said really strikes a chord. It's fascinating. We had old brochures and people's name tags and a whole pile of stuff. And so I've never been a member of Baalbek, but this is resonating fabulously.
How you've gone about the fact that when I need to go to find them, things happened before I came in 9 years ago.
Di, you weren't very clear there. Do you want to try again? This time, make sure the mic is pressed first before you start talking. So maybe give it 2 or 3 seconds. You were just cut out at the beginning and at the end of what you had said. But we'd love to hear what you said. So if you could try again, that would be great.
Yes, I was saying our program's been running for 10 years this year, and I'm trying to do a history of ours, so I'm very interested in how Victoria has done their history.
Margaret and Anne, maybe you'd like to talk about some of the text that you're writing. It seems very interesting that we're all in different states in the same country, and yet we have such a diverse range of skill and, I guess, delivery in terms of adult education.
Well, I came to work in literacy in 1991, the first job I did was a really part-time research job on the National Curriculum Mapping Project, a national project, which I think was undertaken with that new literacy money, you know, after the International Year of Literacy and the White Paper. And one of my jobs was to go and find out and tell the project people who were based in New South Wales what we had in Western Australia. We had 3 courses. They were all very part-time. They could be undertaken 2 hours a week, I think. There were 3 of them. English 1K, which was a bit higher than adult literacy. Adult literacy was the beginning one. And English 1L was for migrants. So really, there wasn't a lot of delivery. And if you said literacy in Western Australia at that time, then people immediately thought of the volunteer tutor scheme. So literacy was volunteering.
Thanks, Margaret. That's really interesting. I'll pass back over to Bev.
Shall I? I'll just try briefly to answer Di's question about how we're going about it. The committee, when they set up the project, wanted a history of Baalbek, but they wanted it through fine print articles. So what I've done is read all. I've got almost a full collection of fine prints, and I've been reading them for the past nearly 2 years now.
It looks like we've lost Bev. She's dropped out there. Whilst she's logging back in, I'm just going to take you, Di, to the Baalbek site. You can everybody see where I've taken you in terms of the web address? If somebody could just give me a smiley face. Thank you, Di. Once you get into here, you'll see a link called Fine Print Journal. If you click on the Fine Print Journal, you'll actually see those picture, the diagram that Bev showed us in her presentation. If you go to the section that says Fine Print is archived and copies of the last few years can be read and downloaded, you will see copies of all of the fine print from the last, I think it's about 10 years. Prior to that, we've got the tables of content. What you can do now is have a bit of a look. If you click on one of those magazines, one of the editions, you should be able to have a look at the tables of content, and we should be able to, you should be able to have a wander through some of the earlier editions. As you scroll down the page, you'll find that all that's there is the table of contents. Eventually we will get to the point where we'll be able to have them all scanned, but this takes a lot of time. So at the moment, what we have up there is the table of contents from about 1990 until about 1999, and then we've got the full edition. Any questions about that?
Debbie, it's Sue. I think last year someone said there were a couple missing. I wondered whether you got them. It looks like volume 18, number 2. There's a blank space. I was just curious about whether you managed to get them all.
Bev would be a better person to ask answer that question because, as she said prior to dropping out, hi Bev and welcome back, she nearly had a full set. So we did put out quite a number of requests for people to check, you know, the back pocket of their filing cabinet and that sort of thing. But yes, I think we're still a couple short. So I'll pass back over to Bev.
We got no Can you hear me now? We got no response at all from the request that Don put out about the missing editions. And I have forgotten now. I've got them all marked down, but I haven't got the list in front of me. I think it was probably about 10 or 15 altogether, but we didn't get any response at all. I'd need to go back to that list to find out which ones they were.
Oh, I did contact him and said I might have had one. So what I'll do is go back and look at my list of them, because I got the collection when the South Australian Council for when the SA TAFE literacy unit closed down. So I'll go back and have a look again, because I sent him an email at some stage.
It was interesting that at one stage we had lots of discussion at the VELBEC meetings, and one of the things that we identified prior to employing Bev was that the State Library of Victoria actually has kept a copy of all of the fine prints. They automatically get a copy and retain them on file. But I'm not sure whether in that process, when Don and Lynn went and had a look, that they actually had all of the copies at their disposal.
Could I also say that the archiving is such an important aspect of all this? It's because people like Daryl Evans and Helen McRae had been meticulous in saving all sorts of documents related to the history of VELBEC, that such a good collection is now available. But of course there's lots of issues around that, about where to store it and who maintains it, and it's great if an organisation can provide a home, but less and less does that seem to be the case. So that's really vital to, you know, make sure that archiving is done as soon as possible, which it sounds like Sue and Margaret and Anne are doing that.
So one of the things, you're right, Delia, that we talked about, you know, we've been talking about this project probably for about 4 years now, and it was one of the big things was how do you archive and where do you make them available and where do you store. So we now actually have a shared space with ACEL, and we are actually getting much better, meticulously better at keeping things and recording where they are and making sure that important files are kept, like fine print articles and editions. So I guess we don't take advantage of doing it, and I guess then when we do, we sort of set in place processes. The other thing that's really good is that we've got technology, which means we can scan our editions and turn them into PDF files, and so hopefully they are never lost.
The issue of archives is really tricky, isn't it? Because it's really, really important that things don't get lost. But storage is one issue, but also how much it's they are used is another issue. And ACAL did have archives that were kept at UTS, and they were not used very much. And so the university claimed back the space, which is now why they've come to Melbourne to be shared with Velbrick Archives. But I think it's really important that that they be kept, and that this history of this organisation doesn't get lost. Can you just go on to the next slide of the PowerPoint, number 31, if you can. Not that one.
Just let me know which one it is, Bev, because I had to split the presentation into two. So I thought number 31 was actually this one. You need to just walk me through.
One after this one, I think, Debbie. And next one. I could say something about research very quickly, but I hadn't planned to. Just see what the next one is. No, look, I think these are not ones that I particularly want to talk about at the moment. I just wanted to show you a couple at the end, which the very first one that was produced in 1993, which shows very clearly the changing of the eras. And I think it also indicates that Velbrick was becoming much more professionalised. And I think that's what this is a history of, that it really is a history of an organisation and a field that's becoming, that has become professionalised. Not only did it become mainstream, but it became professionalised. And some of you who've joined later into the organisation will not be aware, I guess. If you've come into a field that's already professionalised, then you're not aware of those changes, and it's actually really hard to capture what some of those changes are. I don't know those people who are more long-standing with it, Sue, whether you want to say something here about that process of professionalisation.
Oops, sorry, I just posted a little text box that asked if you could talk a bit more about what the markers of professionalism are. That'd be fascinating.
Well, one of the markers, very clear markers in this organisation, I think, is the move from dependency on volunteers to and voluntary labour to paid professionals, and that then meant that people had to that the field became regulated in terms of people having to train to have qualifications to get them jobs. Once volunteers were no longer used as much, and people. There was a big move in the late 80s to move away from one-to-one tuition with volunteers to using teachers in groups. The whole thing about one-to-one became much more an emphasis on group tuition. That meant then that teachers had to be employed to teach the groups. You couldn't depend on volunteers then, and then teachers had to be trained properly. With the proper qualifications, which has always been a moot point in adult literacy, because there was never courses were always tricky. What courses did adult literacy professionals do? There were courses for TESOL people and so on, but there were no specific adult literacy courses for adult literacy professionals. But it meant that people were paid for the work that they did, even though there weren't that many full-time positions available. They were at least paid for the work that they did, rather than volunteering their time.
I don't want to take up too much time, but I'm just wondering, does that mean that volunteerism doesn't exist in Victoria, or that it, or in Vowbeck, or that it exists and has a particular place?
Volunteers are still used in quite a few programs, but certainly not to the extent that they were in the 70s and 80s and even into the 90s. But I think certainly there is still, I know that Carlton Reading and Writing is training volunteers at the moment, but and in the country I think volunteers are still used. So the volunteer component is still there, but I think... I'll leave it at that. Certainly it's still there, but it's not, nothing like it used to be, say, 30 or 25 years ago.
This is Anne. I find it interesting in that in TAFE, in the ESL area, where we have highly trained professional lecturers, that they also set up a complementary volunteer conversation groups where they draw in volunteers, unpaid volunteers from the community to work within the class. So they have a fairly large group, but the volunteer works almost on a one to no, perhaps on a 1-to-4 basis. And as I understand it, although I don't work in ESL myself, but I understand it's a fairly successful collaboration for everybody involved.
And I know that there are some programs in adult literacy programs where, or adult education programs where the adult literacy component, they actually have volunteers in the class, so that they're not unsupported volunteers. They actually come into the classroom and help in the classroom, which is very different from working totally alone with students on a one-to-one basis. I don't know. It'd be interesting to hear what the situation is in South Australia and Western Australia still, with how many volunteers are used there. Margaret or Sue, do you want to say something?
I can tell you that there are about 800 volunteers still working in Western Australia. They probably between them service about 1,000 students, and it is all one-to-one, I would say. The government still pays for the volunteer tutor training, and that management is outsourced to a TAFE college, but it is really quite separate from all of the accredited courses.
In the community and neighbourhood house sector in South Australia, there's a really strong component of volunteerism. I'm not all that sure whether there's a lot of one-to-one that goes on, but I think there might be. And in TAFE, there are no volunteers. I'm just interested in the, I suppose, the implications for it and the funding. I think that, I suppose I'd like to have a bigger conversation about volunteers and one-to-one and the kind of privacy and professional issues that emerge, but that's probably for another Literacy Live.
And the other question that I would think is worth a further conversation is actually how important the role of the journal is, fine print as a journal, that I talk about it as being both a mirror to all of the trends that are going on, but also serving to shape the agenda as well. And it's probably not, there's not time now to talk about that. Maybe that's a question to leave you with, but just to think about the importance of a professional journal such as Fine Print and the role that it plays in actually shaping professional identity. So I don't know whether people have got anything that they'd want to say about whether each state has got a... I know that New South Wales has, and I think some of the other states have, but whether people want to actually comment about what role their own professional journal plays in their in the formation of their professional identity.
Bev, could I just add to what you've said, the importance of the journal in creating and sustaining and invigorating and developing a sense of community amongst adult literacy workers. I think especially as professional development has cut back over the years, and also support staff. I mean, there used to be regional adult literacy support workers that no longer exist. As those things disappeared, the journal has become more and more important as a source of community identity as well as professional identity, and even more, I think, both reflects and shapes the community.
I know one of the things that I remember, just taking up Delia's point too, is that sense of the politics of literacy and a political identity. I know there was a lovely issue on in the old ALRN and ALRN days, dare I say it, when, for those who might not be familiar with that, there was an Adult Literacy and Numeracy Research Consortium, and there was an issue in fine print that really problematised the whole notion of research and what it meant, and of practitioner research. And I go back to that often, and so I think fine print for me, also as someone from outside of the Valbec and Victorian scene, it's provided a really interesting source of debates for me. So, at one level like that, I'm really envious of it.
I think it's quite hard for people in Western Australia to see themselves as part of the community of practitioners, and simply to do with being too thin on the ground, I think. People are often very spread out, one from each other, really in geographical miles often, you know, in outside of the metropolitan area. And even in TAFE colleges, where since 1991 there has been an awful lot more money spent on literacy courses, and we've got accredited courses, and there are now, you know, the paid jobs in literacy. But they're kind of marginalised from, in some respects, I think, from the broader VET community. They're always the poor cousins, and I'm very envious of Victoria because it's geographically small with lots and lots of people, and I think interesting things happen when you have a situation like that that don't happen in a state like Western Australia, where you've just got acres and acres and acres and hardly anybody in it.
Margaret, does Western Australia have a journal that goes with the Adult Literacy Council, and what would you see its role as?
WALC doesn't have a journal. It's I think it's beyond any of us to put a journal up from WALC. We're spread too thin on the ground. It's just a very few people, mostly in the metropolitan area, although we have executive members who don't live in the city. It's really hard to hold meetings when you've got that situation. So people just get worn out. There isn't really the time or the resources to do it. However, in the department, in our paid jobs, we did have a journal which we called the Circular. And then last year, all of a sudden, we weren't allowed to do it anymore because publications going out of the department was suddenly coming under different kinds of strictures. So for no good reason, because it had been very well received, and we were able to put that together in paid time rather than volunteer time. For no good reason, suddenly we weren't allowed to do it. So we don't have any kind of journal on literacy issues at the moment. And I see no hope of getting one, unless we can do something about our finances, which we are looking to, in terms of going out and aggressively looking for sponsorship to do particular jobs, and that might be one of them.
So here, listening to Margaret talk too, I think that issue of critical mass is really important. Just the sheer number of people that you have available, I think, means that there's a qualitatively different kind of engagement that people can have. But I'd also say, here in South Australia, I don't work in the literacy field, so I'm speaking from outside of it there. But I think also that there are some divisions that have been created around the strength of the volunteer movement that we have here in South Australia, and therefore there is a very distinct community provision and TAFE provision, TAFE and private provider provision. So that too creates some differences about, I think presents a lot of challenges for a group like SACAL to really try and keep evenly up on the table the issues across both of those sectors and at the same time be active and put out a journal. At the moment where we have trouble even putting out an electronic newsletter. It's quite interesting, just the sheer struggle to find time to do that kind of work.
I think as well, the new technologies have changed things dramatically. That that VALBEC has an eVALBEC that goes out once a month, as most of you probably subscribe to, but it's got 900 people or something on that it goes out to, but there are only 120 people who are actually members of VALBEC. And so that discrepancy makes you wonder what the future of VALBEC is. As long as there are people who are prepared to do the hard work, then it will continue. But if there is nobody to replace, say, Don when he goes, then what will happen to it in the next generation is a really, even though the new technologies give lots of possibilities, it also puts at risk, I think, what does happen to it, since it's only a virtual, it's not only a virtual presence, but it is a strong virtual presence, but it needs people to continue that presence as well. So it is a question of the future. What is the future of VALBEC and other, the other state organisations as well? Where are they headed?
It's very, very interesting conversation tonight. And I guess whilst I've been around for about 15 years, I'm probably one of the younger ones in the ALBE field, looking to all of you as the experts. And my take on all of this is you're quite right, Bev, in terms of saying that it's a lot of work. And I think the difference between having listened to or having been at the 30th dinner and having heard some of the talk about the first 15 years of particularly of VALBEC, people had time. People seem to have had more time. And Daryl Evans was my boss for many years, and we used to have lots of interesting conversations. And one of the things that he said was, when he'd started and when he was working in the early days, people had time to have the dialogue, to have the conversation, to have the professional conversation. We don't have that time now. And I guess that whilst you had the professional dialogue, you don't. You also had the time to do these things. I don't know how we will survive in the future. We're lucky that we've still got good support. We're lucky that we've got a good committee. We're lucky that we've still got ACFI state funding. So,
I wonder if we could go back to a point that Pauline made, just still talking around fine print, asking Sue about her notion of purpose when she was referring to it being fine print being different from, say, literacy and numeracy studies or other academic journals.
Yes, Delia, I was just typing, so I thought I can't respond. But I haven't. My understanding of fine print or my impressions about it might be different from where it's gone to more recently. But I got a feeling that a lot of the fine print articles are written from the field and are also able to be raising issues on the hop. And I don't know about anyone else, but if I write for an academic journal, then there's no way that the writing on the hop's going to get accepted. It's just such a different kind of work that's submitted and accepted. And so I think the role of fine print fits a really interesting space that some people, I suspect, would say it's an academic journal, but it doesn't seem to fit the tough, stringent, sometimes extremely difficult role that certain academic journals play. And it also doesn't seem to be like a newsletter. It it fits into a really interesting space. And I think also the role of fine print in creating the space for where the field is going to go to has been interesting too. It can actually almost flag on the hop and respond on the hop to certain policy positions or shifts in funding that might be happening at the time of going to print. So it'd be interesting to hear more about whether it is able to do that kind of on-the-run stuff.
Well, we're getting up close to 9 o'clock. I'm not sure whether there's any final comments that we'd like to make, or perhaps some they could be comments to Bev or about the project, or perhaps about further conversation that we can have through Literacy Live. So I'll hand over the microphone again.
Debbie, I think what you've just written about many a first-time writers, there would be a really interesting project, I think, another one, Bev, in following up people who are first-time writers in fine print and seeing where they've gone with their writing. Because I think in terms of a profession and in terms of pathways and in terms of growing ideas from inside the field, that's exactly the kind of vehicle that a profession needs. It's something that gets people writing. And then they move on and then come back also to write again for fine print.
And I think that's the beauty of fine print, that it that right from the start it did encourage practitioners to write, but it also manages now to hold a balance between those who are first time writers and those who are more experienced writers, because it is actually certainly the field in Victoria is a highly theorised field. And people are able to write about that those theoretical frameworks that sit alongside first-time writers, and I think that's the beauty of it as a journal. It's a professional-looking journal, but it's not a refereed journal, and so the process of peer review doesn't slow down the production that people are asked to write or that they might offer something that they want published, but I think it's more about inviting people to write stuff where first-time writers can sit along more experienced writers.
And I'll only be a few seconds because I think Margaret's question is really important, but I think one of the reasons those freedoms are possible and that range of voices and genres and preoccupations is that a really good format has emerged. It's taken quite a while, but people like the rhythm between the lead articles that tend to focus on a theme, and then there's interviews with teachers and there's practical matters and there's an international perspective. So I think that sort of format that's evolved over the years also ensures those freedoms and that democracy.
Thanks, Delia. And just to answer Margaret's question, I'm not sure that I can answer it. Having buried my head so deeply for the last 18 months in the history, I don't have a real sense of what's actually happening in the field at the moment in terms of real life practice, except that I was at the Valbec conference a few weeks ago, and there was a very strong sense that there is a field out there and people are committed to working in the field. It's certainly not as big as it was, but I think there will continue to be a group of people who look to teach adult literacy and basic education in whatever context it might be, and that those people need nurturing and they need supporting. So I would hope that people also see that involvement requires commitment from them to actually keep the organisation going as well. Don't know if that's answered your question, Margaret, but I'm not a very good crystal ball gazer.
Thanks, Bev. I was interested in just one of your comments when you said there's still a field, but it's not as big as it used to be. I'd like you to talk a little bit more about that if there's time. Because I suspect there may be now more paid professionals in adult literacy than there were when I entered in 1991. But I'm aware that WI would have been a very different place to Victoria at that time. So I'm just questioning my own assumption that actually there are lots of people with paid jobs, perhaps fewer volunteers, but lots of more people with paid jobs. And I'm wondering if this, the numbers seem lower because they're not there at a conference, they're not there undertaking extracurricular voluntary activity, they're not there as activists in the same sort of way. There isn't perhaps the same enthusiasm or sense of drive or something, I don't know.
Bev, did you want to respond to that?
I was just waiting because it looked as though Sue was trying to come in. I won't try and answer Sue's question, but to go back to Margaret's about the diminishing fields, I think there probably are more, and that's part of my point about it becoming professionalised, that there are probably more paid professionals. It still is a field that doesn't offer real career paths for people, I think, and it still, I think, continues to be, even though people talk about it becoming mainstream and coming in from the margins, I think it is still a field that's on the margins because of that lack of career paths and because it's still largely a feminised field. But I think there will continue to be people who still need adult literacy and basic education. And Debbie's question that she's just put up now, how many people do call themselves ALBI practitioners, and is ALBI a term that's actually going out of fashion? I don't know.
We've hit the 9:05 mark. I think it's been a really interesting conversation. Perhaps if you'd like to make a comment or send an email regarding a follow-up session, that would be really interesting, perhaps picking up on this volunteerism, how it's working, where models of use around Australia might be a very interesting one. It might be interesting, Sue and Margaret and Bev and Delia, to pick up on a conversation with perhaps some of the academics that are working in some of the universities and talk to them about how they perceive adult literacy students, students practicing or becoming qualified, receiving qualification in adult literacy, to see where they're going and where, what their inspirations and perceptions are about the field. Thank you very much, Bev. Everybody might like to give Bev a smiley face. You did a marvellous job in your first session as a guest speaker in a Literacy Live, so well done. Thank you everyone for your time tonight. It's been terrific.